9 years on Political Truth. Oh, is it live right now?
Yeah, we're live. You said you spent 9 years writing Into the Nightmare. That's what I saw.
We spent 31 years writing Into the
Nightmare. 31. Okay, well, I was wrong.
But Political Truth, I started in the 90s and put it aside, and I spent about a year writing that one, just for your information.
Cool. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have a very special guest, returning guest. This will be his third time on the show. His name is Joseph McBride. And we spoke earlier this year about an excellent book about somebody people should look into, Billy Wilder, his book, Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge. And then we also spoke about Political Truth, which you'll see here on the screen if you're watching on YouTube or Rockfin. Total full title of that book is Political Truth, The Media and the Assassination of President Kennedy. But today we're going to talk about an earlier book that I reached out to him because I didn't know much about this other part of the whole mystery of JFK, which is the killing of J.D. Tippit. And the title of this book we're going to talk about today is Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit, T-I-P-P-I-T, published 2013. There's Kindle and a paperback version. And Joseph McBride is an American film historian, biographer, screenwriter, and professor in the School of Cinema at San Francisco State University. He's published 24 books, including acclaimed biographies of Frank Capra, John Ford, and Steven Spielberg. And this book is Into the Nightmare, contains many fresh revelations from his rare interviews with people in Dallas, archival discoveries, and what novelist Thomas Flanagan in the New York Review of Books called McBride's wide knowledge of American social history, which also informs his book that you're seeing here today, Political Truth. And so I'm delighted to have him back. Joseph McBride, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much, William. It's great to be with you. As before, we had a wonderful time, so it's great talking to you.
Excellent. So for people who may not have heard our earlier discussions, maybe you could just take a minute, and you have a long career, a long CV. Just talk about your interest in the JFK assassination, your research, and what led you to write Into the Nightmare.
Well, I was a volunteer on Senator Kennedy's campaign for president in Wisconsin during the primary in 1960. My mother, Marion Dunn McBride, was a prime person in the Wisconsin Democratic Party. She became vice chairman the following year. And she and Pat Lucy, who were the state chairman, switched their allegiance from Hubert Humphrey, who was kind of Wisconsin's favorite son. He was the senator neighboring Minnesota, and he was called our third senator because we had two conservative Republicans, including Joe McCarthy, in the Senate. And so if the liberals wanted anything done, they'd go to Humphrey, and he was celebrated among liberals. But Pat Lucy and my mother switched to Kennedy, which really helped him in the campaign. And Kennedy told Lucy after he became president, he said, "I couldn't have become president unless I'd won the Wisconsin primary." It wasn't totally decisive, but it helped establish him on the national scene. And if he had lost it, his campaign would have been over. But I was a volunteer. I met him twice during that campaign. The first time was a very small rally my mother organized called Kids for Kennedy, two blocks from my house. And he mingled with kids and their mothers at a noontime rally. And I got to talk to him about Profiles in Courage. And he asked a question about Profiles in Courage. I just read it, and he quipped. He said, "Only in Wisconsin," when I answered the question. And he said, "I hope I don't have to run against you for president in 1964, which is about the nicest thing anybody said to me. And then I met him at a big rally in downtown Milwaukee on April 3rd, 1960, 2 days before the primary. And there were 3,000 people there, and I got to shake his hand and talk to him and his wife. And I was struck on both occasions by the lack of security. When he arrived at the little event, he was with only an aide and a reporter who might have been Theodore White, who was writing The Making of the President then. And at the big rally in Milwaukee, there was a policeman there, but he was not very close to him, and people were just, going up and shaking the hands of Kennedy. And I was already a student of the Lincoln assassination, and the Civil War was a big passion of mine. So I wrote a short story in October 1961 about Kennedy's assassination called The Plot Against a Country. And it was for my high school English class at Marquette University High School. So I was already concerned about his lack of security. And the story is juvenilia, but I had some things in there that were prescient in a way. I mean, I talked about the importance of his autopsy and how they penetrated security. But although I stole the murder method from a Superman comic book. So I was not totally surprised when he was shot, but I heard it from a student in the cafeteria line at Marquette High School. And my first reaction was to laugh incongruously because I thought he was kidding, but I realized he wasn't. So I ran two blocks to a radio in a drugstore where I knew that there'd be a radio going. And I listened from 1240 to 1:30. And the thing that struck me was the network radio reports were all saying for the first 20 minutes that the shots came from the front, either from a grassy hill, which we now call the grassy knoll, or from the railroad bridge. And it wasn't until 1 o'clock they started saying the shots came from behind, from a building called the Texas School Book Depository. And what struck me was I was already a journalist. I had been since 1960. And I was aware that when you change a story without explaining it, there's a red flag goes up in my mind that there's something fishy going on. And if they had explained it, okay, but they didn't bother. And as the day went on and I was watching the network news, I saw Oswald being dragged through the halls of the police station saying, "I'm just a patsy." I saw his midnight press conference where he said, "I didn't shoot anybody, and I would like a lawyer, like legal representation," which he never got. And by the end of the day, I wasn't believing the official story. And I wrote about this in Into the Nightmare. I wrote a whole chapter on what I call the media docudrama of the assassination. It was, if you look at it as a drama, it was a four-day miniseries, kind of. First day, there's a big surprise, shock, president killed, suspect arrested. Then they tried and convicted Oswald on network TV. And I remember when I was 16, I was very bothered by that because it was the first time I was really aware that in America, the media try people and convict them. And that's not the way the Constitution is supposed to work. We're supposed to have a trial and legal representation. And I was very bothered by that. And then this suspect got shot on national TV. And then the following day, you know, the grand spectacle of the funeral, which everybody thought was so wonderful, but I write that it was kind of an unfortunate event in the sense that it tranquilized the public and people were questioning already what happened, and all the news kind of stopped for a day for the grand ceremony. It was also a military funeral. And when you study the assassination, the military was involved in the coup d'etat. So here's the military burying Kennedy. And, you know, in some countries, if the leader is killed, people go out in the streets and protest or riot or whatever they do. And in America, 93% of the sets were tuned to the assassination, to the funeral, which was the all-time record. So we were all kind of atomized in the sense that we were not on the streets, not meeting in public. We were sitting in our houses watching TV. And then the media kind of moved on. To me, the most disturbing comment among many made about the assassination in the media, Dan Rather, who's been all over the story, he for example, he was the CBS Southwestern bureau chief. He worked out in New Orleans, but he had been working in Dallas before that. And the other two networks, ABC and NBC, each had one camera crew with Kennedy, a cameraman, a reporter, and another person. But Dan Rather persuaded CBS to have five camera crews in Dallas, which was extraordinary. And he said, "I was prepared for something to happen." He claimed, "I didn't know what would happen," but he must have had some, you know, impossible inside information. And CBS had the only live hookup at the Trademark, which some people thought was a danger spot for Kennedy. And so I got deeply into this in Political Truth, my recent book on the media and the assassination. But I thought of writing a chapter on the media for Into the Nightmare, but it became too big a subject for one chapter. So I just wrote this one chapter, and Jacqueline Kennedy had orchestrated the funeral, and it was full coverage. CBS actually called the shots. And what Dan Rather said 20 years later in one of his retrospective specials on the assassination, actually it was a CBS morning program, he said, you know, the day I think of is Tuesday, November 26th. He said, the day America went back to work and we all resumed our jobs and the system worked. And on the contrary, I remember that as the bleakest of the days, because I went back to high school and, you know, I wondered, you know, what had happened to our country. And the feeling was extremely grim and bleak, and I didn't know where we were going. And I imagine millions of other people felt the same way. That was the day also when, at the end of school, I went downtown in Milwaukee to a newspaper and magazine store, and they had stacks of Life magazine, which didn't arrive at homes until later in the week, but it came out on Tuesday, and they had the first frames from the Zapruder film in black and white, and that was a big revelation. So, you know, the media from the beginning have blown the story or slanted the story all over the place. Carl Bernstein did a famous article in Rolling Stone in 1970 on the CIA and the media, how they penetrated the media. He estimated at the time that there were about 400 people working in the media who either were working for the CIA and they were reporters undercover, or they were reporters who were feeding stories to the CIA and getting leaks from the CIA and doing their bidding. And he named the three leading CIA outlets as the New York Times, CBS, and Time Life, Time Incorporated. And he went kind of soft on his former employees, the Washington Post, but they're one of the worst offenders because in 1951, Phil Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, helped found Operation Mockingbird for the CIA, which Frank Wisner, the CIA, was running. And that was the infiltration of the media by the CIA. So this continues to the present day. I mean, for example, Jeff Bezos, the owner of Washington Post, is very openly doing business with the CIA. And so the Post has been a CIA front from the beginning. And so the media have lied to us, the mainstream media have lied to us from day one, with very rare exceptions. But it's the alternate media, William, like you and other podcasters and bloggers on the internet publications. The internet gets a lot of knocks, but I think it's a force for democracy in many ways, because despite the, you know, hate speech and crazy sites that go on, it gives a room for alternate voices that the mainstream media don't allow us. So that's where that and books are where the race is really examined, you know, because there's more freedom in books than there is in newspapers and magazines, because you have less mediation. Yeah, the books published by the main publishers, the few publishers that are the big ones, tend to be pro-Warren Commission books, but the dissenting books are published by a few small publishers. But also you can self-publish now, which is a big revolution in publishing. It used to be considered the vanity press. It was looked down upon, but now it's a very big scale business. You know, you can have your book designed by a good designer, which I do, and set in type easily. And then you hire a fulfillment house to do print on demand, shipping the book, and you can sell it through Amazon. And that's what I've done with Into the Nightmare of Political Truth. And they keep selling very well all over the world. And
congrats. And you get the lion's share of the money, not to some publisher too.
Yeah, I mean,
And you avoid this word that I learned from, what was her name, Dutton, who wrote Thy Will Be Done about Nelson Rockefeller, which is this word privishing, where you can take your book and a publisher can pick it up, but then they'll just put it on the shelf and not promote it. So self-publishing has that advantage too, is where self-promotion is another component of the self-publishing.
So yeah, you got to do that, but you kind of have to do that with mainstream publishers. I still do mainstream books. For example, Columbia University Press has published my book, How Did Lubitsch Do It, about Ernst Lubitsch and my Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge. Very good publisher. But authors still have to do a lot of the promotion, and I've learned how to do that. I have a lot of media contacts, and there are many, as I say, podcasts that keep calling on me for interviews, and it's a way to reach the public directly, and you get a good share of the money from self-publishing, but you do have to share some money with Amazon and with the fulfillment house for printing it, but that's fair. And you get the money quickly, and you probably get even more of a share than you do from a publisher. You don't get an advance, but you get consistent royalties.
And you also get control too. So it's your voice. Like, this book is your voice, right? Into the Nightmare. So you really can put, like, my voice comes through in my books. It's the subtext, but I think that warts and all, whatever I put out is mine. Yeah. And so I think that people will appreciate that, as opposed to somebody meddling with my final text and editing. Yeah. We don't want to cover that. No, this is shaping the author's authentic words, I think, is really kind of what some publishers can do.
Yes, you have complete control, and I really wanted that for sure, because, if you go with a mainstream publisher, as good as they might be, you deal with editors. And, Peter Dale Scott, who's a very good historian, wrote a fine book called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK. He published it with the University of California Press, and I've had books with them, and they're a good publisher. But he had to pull some punches, apparently. In certain areas, he was kind of told not to go too far. But with my two books, I put exactly in there what I want to put in there, and people can quarrel with it if they want, but that's fine.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
I used to, when I was at Berkeley, I used to pass Peter Dale Scott.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
They say their gate back in the day. So I remember him. And they used to have, like, the rudimentary website was a website called Deep Politics, where you could read his stuff. So yeah. He has found a way around kind of any type of editorializing. But he was one of the early ones. Yeah.
He coined that term, Deep Politics, which deals with the real people running the government behind the scenes. You know, we think the people we elect run it, but there's a layer behind it. I mean, one example, this is very timely, is that under the JFK Records Act, which was passed in 1993 as a result of Oliver Stone's JFK, that film highlighted that millions of pages of documents were still classified in the Kennedy assassination. And if a lone nut with no motive shot Kennedy, why are they hiding so many documents? So Congress passed an act mandating they release all documents. There are a few exceptions if national security or sources and methods are involved. They can still make a decision to classify some, but the intent was to get everything out within 25 years, and they've released millions of pages of documents. The National Archives has them online, too. I used to have to go to the National Archives in person when I was starting my research in the 80s for Into the Nightmare. I'd go to the National Archives and Xerox stuff. It was time-consuming and expensive. But now you can read a lot online. However, there are something like 15,000 documents that are still classified after 59 years. And President Trump announced that he was going to release all the documents on schedule. They had the deadline. And then a day or two before the release was planned, the CIA and the FBI got to him and told him not to release, you know, some documents. And the CIA is involved in the majority of the hidden documents. And so he kicked the can down the road to Biden. And Biden released a few documents, but he's still not totally complying with the law. And in mid-December, he's supposed to release more. But I'm sure that there will be some withheld, even though some will probably be released. And that's something the public should be concerned about. You know, why are certain things being hidden? I mean, I'll give you one example of what's hidden. There's a journalist named Jefferson Morley who used to work for the Washington Post, and he had trouble getting assassination articles published there. So he moved on, and he's been conducting a campaign in the courts for years to get documents released about George Ioannidis, who was a CIA officer who was the liaison with the House Select Committee for Assassinations. He was supposed to facilitate releases of papers from the CIA, but in fact, he didn't tell them. He was the case officer who was handling the anti-Castro Cubans in the Miami station at the time of the assassination, and some of those people are suspects in the assassination. And he probably knew about Oswald's activities in New Orleans that summer with anti-Castro Cubans, and in which Oswald was posing as a anti-Castro person. And so anyway, Ioannidis lied to the House Select Committee, and a lot of the documents about him are still classified. And so there's something to hide there, and we really should know what went on.
I've done four interviews with Jefferson Morley. So I've done his most recent book, excellent book, highly recommend, which is Scorpion's Dance. And people can check that out. And it does fall into the JFK because Helms and Nixon would just say to each other, the Bay of Pigs thing. They wouldn't say the JFK assassination. But you get the picture that they both knew that there was a no-go sensitive zone that neither of them really wanted to discuss. And Helms was kind of an underling of Dulles. And but yeah, Jefferson Morley, I think he did another one, CIA, JFK versus CIA, which is about his litigation that ended up in front of Kavanaugh, actually. And then
you interviewed him, give him a platform, and he could talk about the issues involved. Books keep coming out every day. I just got one in the mail, my good friend Joe Green. I don't know if you've had Joe Green.
I interviewed Joe Green last week, so I talked to him just about tinfoil.
Wonderful. Yeah, Tinfoil Hat Not Included, Conspiracy Theories in Art and Practice. He is a wonderful guy and a great researcher and a very good writer. And so I got that in the mail today, and I'm really excited. I'm going to read that right away. And there's a book by Paul Gregory, who is an acquaintance of Oswald, who thinks Oswald did it. That's a new book. So books keep coming out, you know, and it's a very healthy environment to have books of all kinds out. And a lot of researchers are busy on the case and doing good for the public. And thank you for having them on. And thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm glad. I'm glad to have you back. I mean, and I think one of the interesting aspects about this book, Into the Nightmare, is how personal it is for you, this case. You had a lot of similarities with Kennedy, kind of maybe your background. And so it was kind of when you were 16 when he was killed, it was very, very kind of affected your family. Your parents knew him as well, right?
Yeah, my mother, as I say, worked for him and with him. And I met him again in 62 when he was president. He came to Milwaukee to do a Jefferson Jackson Day dinner address. And I was one of the honor guard, just kind of, you know, walking around. And at the end of the event, everybody had left. And I walked up to the podium, which had the presidential seal on it. And I found Kennedy's speech copy with notes that he had doodled on it. Some writing and pictures of sailboats and stuff. And I was debating whether to steal this document from the President of the United States. And being a staunch Catholic kid at the time, I was, I felt guilty about stealing it. So I was contemplating this, and a Secret Service man came up and took the presidential seal. And then he took the papers, and I said, could I have those? And he said, no, this is secret because the president might've written something about Berlin, is what he claimed. So he walked away, and then I heard a commotion behind me. There was a curtain. So I pulled the curtain, and Kennedy walked 5 feet from me. He was right there, and I impulsively called out, hi, Jack. And he smiled and turned, walked down a ramp into the limousine in which he'd be killed a year later. That's the last time I saw him. But I was, so it meant a lot to me personally. It changed my life because I was going to go into politics. I was going to become a lawyer and a politician. And I lost faith in our political system, and you know, when your candidate is murdered and they didn't solve the crime, that profoundly bothered me about the United States. And I was confused by the Warren Commission report, which I read when it came out. And, you know, temporarily I kind of believed it because we were raised back then to believe in the government and the media. And a huge percentage of the public before the assassination automatically believed what the government said. And it took me until the Vietnam War started heating up a year or two later, as a direct result of the assassination, that I began questioning the government. And I was a protester in Madison when I went to college. And in 66, a number of books came out questioning the case, Mark Lane's book and Inquest by Edward J. Epstein, exposed the dubious methods of the Warren Commission. In 67, Sylvia Mara's book, Accessories After the Fact, which I still think is the best book on the assassination. So by then I was beginning to have my old skepticism come back. And so it changed my whole life. I devoted myself to being a writer, which I was going to do anyway. But my purpose as a writer, in all that I write, is to expose hidden truths, because I felt I'd been lied to systematically as a kid by the government, by the media, by my parents, by the Catholic Church. And you know, I rejected all those things and began to think for myself, which we should all do. And I started writing more and more books. And when I write film history books, such as my biographies of Capra and John Ford and Steven Spielberg, I delve behind the official facade of these people and come up with a lot of revelations, things that, I mean, my Capra book took 7 years. I spent 4 years fighting a legal battle to get it out because Capra's archivist, Janine Basinger of Wesleyan University, and the famous editor, Bob Gottlieb of Knopf, who's Robert Caro's editor, tried to either stop the book or gut the book of the revelations I've made. The Capra was an informer during the blacklist period, for example, and nobody knew that. So I had to fight this battle to get it out, and I got it out through a more honest publisher, Simon & Schuster. And I didn't realize I was assembling material for another book. I did a book called Frankly Unmasking Frank Capra in 2019. I kept voluminous notes on the legal fight. So I wrote this long book about how difficult it is to tell the truth about a public figure in America and all the opposition you get. And, but I prevailed, and, The same is true of the assassination. You know, I mean, like for a long time, I would try to talk to my friends and family about it, and people would not want to talk about it, or they would ridicule. That's a common thing you still see today. People ridicule conspiracy theories. And today, the words conspiracy theories are tossed around all the time. The words don't really mean much anymore because they're tossed around even when they're not conspiracy theories. They're just, you know, disagreements on what's true. And but you get a lot of criticism and stigmatization, and people used to say people are crazy for studying, for having dissident views. But, you know, after a while, I learned how to not worry about that stuff and very forthrightly talk about the assassination. So I started in 82 my serious research, by which I mean every day I study the case, and I began to go to Washington and Dallas and interview people. And it took 31 years to get into the nightmare out. And as you and I were talking about, it's framed as a first-person investigation, my search for the killers of Kennedy and Officer Tippit. I figured that was the best way to tell the story, how I learned about it, how my views grew and changed. And I think I'm like many, many people in my initial skepticism. For example, the Gallup poll about a week after the assassination showed that a majority of Americans didn't believe that Oswald had done it alone. They didn't ask whether he did it at all, but one of the Gallup leaders said a few years ago that consistently 70% of Americans don't believe the Warren Report. It's a little lower than that now, but the public is smarter than the politicians. They see through the lies. And it took a long time to sort this out. The Tippit case is very enigmatic, very complex. And I started writing. While I was doing that, I was writing about the media, too, and I put that aside. I actually tried to sell a book on the media and the assassination in the 90s to some mainstream publishers and didn't get a positive response. One editor said, I believe there is a conspiracy, but we can't publish this book because you want to attack the New York Times, and we rely on the New York Times for book reviews, and we can't afford to antagonize. And that tells you the kind of attitude in the media that stifles dissent. And a lot of people, I think, in the media actually share that kind of belief that the editor had, that they know that the story doesn't add up in terms of the official story, but they're afraid to tell the truth or to get behind it. And a realization I've had over the years is that every major event in American history since 1960, the official story doesn't make any sense and it falls apart the minute you examine it. For example, Kennedy assassination, Vietnam, Watergate, Iran-Contra, the Gulf War, the 9/11, the Iraq War, Afghanistan War, all those things, the official story is ridiculous, actually.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
You can actually throw in MLK and RFK. Those are too.
Yeah, and Malcolm X.
Malcolm X, yeah.
Big story.
Fred Hampton, yeah.
Major assassinations where the official story is a cover story. And it's interesting, though, in Malcolm X's case, the guys who were named as assassins, some of them had nothing to do with it, and two of them were exonerated recently by the New York authorities. One guy had died in prison, unfortunately, but another guy got out and he's suing New York. And the New York Times reports on that, and there was a good Netflix series on that. And Spike Lee did a book on Malcolm X to go along with his film, and he talked about some of the anomalies in the case. But, you know, it's safer to talk about Malcolm X than it is to talk about the president, because as important as Malcolm X was, and he was a hero of mine, he was not president, he didn't have the great power. He was a threat to the establishment, as was Martin Luther King. But you can be a little more frank, but if you're saying the government covered up and maybe was involved in the assassination of the president, that shakes people's confidence in the government. And the media are basically an arm of the government. They see their job as propping up the government's credibility, even if it's dubious, you know.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned Rather, Cronkite. A lot of these guys kind of went on, get back to work. It sounds like after 9/11 too, George Bush, get back to work, people. You know, everything's normal. We fixed this whole problem. But media still impact. They're not. Yeah, it's part of the state. The fourth estate is the first estate, I guess.
Well, Bush told the public after 9/11, he said, you know, like about 2 weeks later, he said, go to Disney World, travel, have a good time. You know, I mean, this is really outrageous. But they, you know, they managed to shut down dissent over that. I mean, Bush didn't declare a day of national mourning so people could think about it. And then after a while, after he blamed Osama bin Laden, he said, well, I don't think about him much anymore, you know. And I mean, it goes down a memory hole, and the facts were covered up by another government investigation. You know, the report was full of lies and errors and omissions, and that's the way it works in our country, because these issues are too sensitive to treat honestly. So, you know, it takes individual citizens to do the job. And I'm gratified that, you know, the heroes of the case really to me are the civilians who came out and spoke out, told the truth. There are a lot of brave people who told the truth about what they saw in Dallas that day. For example, Aquila Clemens, I dedicate my book to her and a couple of other people, Mary Ann Moorman, who's still alive, and S.M. Holland, who were three witnesses who told stories that were different from the official story. And Aquila Clemens was a black lady who was a domestic working half a block away from the Tippit shooting. And she went outside and she saw two guys involved running off in different directions, and neither looked like Oswald. And they tried to deny she existed in the Warren report. And a policeman came to her 2 days afterwards and threatened her if she spoke out, but she spoke out bravely to the press, and she gave an interview to Mark Lane and Emil D'Antonio for their documentary film version of Rush to Judgment, and she was never seen again. And I and other people tried to find her. Today, if she were alive, she'd be like 110 or something, but she disappeared off the face of the earth, and she was threatened by the police, and she said they came around and warned her you might get hurt if you talked about it. But these people were honest citizens who told the truth and believed in the law, and we have to honor them. So there are good people out there who are dedicated to the Constitution and to the rule of law.
It was dangerous, too. A lot of people, was it Belzer's book, Hit List, a lot of suspicious deaths from the beginning around. Not just, it was a huge cover-up that entailed a lot of violence, a lot of people, even people involved probably, who might have been involved, Mack Wallace maybe, I don't know, he died suspiciously, but they're citizens, and I forgot the guy at the train track who saw something, I thought he died as suspiciously.
So there's Bowers. Yeah, there were Penn Jones Jr., who was a crusading small-town Texas newspaper editor and publisher, owned his own printing press. Somebody said once, you only have freedom of speech in America if you own your own printing press. Penn Jones did. He was a feisty guy, lived outside Dallas, and he found a lot of the leads and witnesses, and he made some mistakes, but he did a tremendous job, and I got to know him. He was kind of a role model and a mentor of mine, and he told me, as he told other people, he said, take one aspect of the case, one that hasn't been sufficiently examined, and research the hell out of it. And that's very good advice. I took that with the Tippit case, because I began thinking, as other people had, that Tippit's murder was not investigated properly. The Dallas police dropped the investigation basically when Oswald was shot 2 days later. And Jim Lavelle, the lead detective in the case who I interviewed, gave me a really good interview. He said, well, we continued investigating it if tips came in, but you know, they probably didn't do much. But that's remarkable. When a brother officer is killed, you'd think they would want to solve the crime, but they didn't.
Wasn't Lavelle, sorry to interrupt, but wasn't Lavelle the guy who was taking Oswald out when Ruby shot him?
Yeah. In the picture, you see the tall guy in a white suit and a cowboy hat. He was handcuffed to Oswald, and he participated in the interrogations of Oswald. And he told me a remarkable thing. He said that the day of the assassination, Captain Will Fritz, the head of homicide who was in charge of the case, told him that we need to nail Oswald for the Tippit murder because we don't really have enough evidence to nail him for the murder of the president. And if you look at the situation with the evidence, they really didn't have a case on Oswald for killing the president. So he said, let's get him on the Tippit murder. And a little known document that I found at the National Archives, an FBI document, points out Oswald was never arraigned for the murder of Kennedy, only for the murder of Tippit. He was charged with both later that night. But they really wanted to get him on Tippit. And it's a specious logic they sold the public that if somebody killed this officer fleeing, he must have killed the president. Well, that doesn't logically make sense. There could be other reasons why somebody would kill a policeman. But the evidence is very weak. The ballistics evidence, which is really conclusive, was analyzed by an FBI expert who came and testified to the Warren Commission. He said, we couldn't match the bullets found in Tippit's body to the pistol that Oswald was said to have had. We couldn't match them. And there were two different kinds of bullets used and different shells and all kinds of anomalies with the evidence. So as Oswald called it, the so-called evidence.
All right. What's the so-called narrative of Oswald killing Tippit? Well, he had to do specific things to be where Tippit was to kill him, right? Based upon the timeline. Isn't that correct?
Tippit was killed about 108 or 109, which is about 38 minutes after Kennedy was killed. And he was patrolling a street in Oak Cliff, which is a suburb. And you can reach Oak Cliff by the viaduct from Dallas in 5 minutes driving across the viaduct. And Tippit was doing a lot of unusual things. First of all, he was not in his own patrol district. He was way out of his district. The officer who had that district was William Menzel, who I found out was involved with Tippit in the plot. Tippit was seen at 12:45, 15 minutes after the assassination, sitting in his squad car at a gas station overlooking the viaduct. Five people who knew him saw him sitting there, and he was probably looking for Oswald coming from downtown. He was supposed to be on a bus, and he did get on a bus briefly, and then he exited. The bus was stopped in traffic, so he got a cab, and he came by cab. So Tippit didn't find Oswald, so he took off at a high rate of speed, and he was headed for a different location. Then he was seen shortly after 1 o'clock, around 1 o'clock. He pulled over a guy on 10th Street named Andrews, who was driving his car, and Tippit pulled his car in front of him and rushed over, didn't say anything. He pulled up in the back seat or looked in the back seat. There was nobody in the back seat. And Andrews saw his name tag, Tippit, and then Tippit took off. And then he was seen again shortly after 1 o'clock on Jefferson Boulevard, the main street in Oak Cliff, which is parallel to 10th, where Tippit was killed. Tippit ran into a record store that he was known at. He had bought records there. There were people there, and one of whom knew Tippit, one of the workers, and he said Tippit ran over to a telephone that they had there, and you could still see the telephone. And he picked up the phone, called a number, and didn't have a conversation. And we don't know if he heard anything or not, but he slammed on the telephone, ran out the door, and then the guy saw him taking off in his squad car to 10th Street, turning right toward where he was killed. And a few minutes later, he was shot. And Oswald supposedly was driven by the cab driver to a few blocks beyond his rooming house, which was 0.9 miles from where Tippit was shot. And Oswald then walked back to the rooming house as if he was trying to avoid detection. And his housekeeper said she saw him come in a hurry and changed his jacket and allegedly picked up a gun. But John Armstrong has done a remarkable book called Harvey and Lee, in which he spent 10 years doing the most exhaustive research and proving there were two people running, the CIA was running two people under the name of Lee Oswald. One was Lee Henry Oswald, one was Lee Harvey Oswald. And those two names were both reported in the press that day as suspects. And it sounds kind of far-fetched, but Oswald was seen in two places frequently at the same time, and a lot of strange sightings, and people early on noticed that, and they were trying to figure out how this could be. And a guy named Richard Popkin wrote a book called The Second Oswald. He didn't do the kind of research Armstrong did. He spent 10 years on it. But in spycraft, it's not unusual to have the same name used by different agents, because it gives plausible deniability. If somebody, say, does something in New Orleans, they could say, well, he was really in North Carolina at the time, you know. That's why they do it. And so anyway, supposedly, the Warren version is Oswald walked 0.9 miles, and Tippit pulled him over for whatever reason. One story they put out was that he matched the description over the radio, but he really didn't match that description very well. And the source of the description is not clear. A Dallas policeman evidently called it in. But then there was this confrontation where they were talking across the hood of the car, and then Oswald allegedly shot him, took off, ran, and was seen at the theater. According to the Warren report, his whereabouts were not accounted for half an hour, which is kind of odd because the theater is very close to the shooting site. But when you look into the case, all kinds of things are wrong. Oswald's housekeeper saw him standing outside the house about 1:04, waiting for somebody to come by. And a police car had pulled up outside the rooming house when Oswald was there and beeped its horn twice. That's suspicious. And Oswald was standing there. And so if he shot Tippit at 1:08 or 1:09, that's not enough time to walk that route. I've walked that route many times. You know, when you walk fast, you still can't make it that fast. And nobody saw him walking or running or being driven there. The Warren Commission moved the time of the shooting to 1:15 to make it possible for somebody to walk that far. And that's specious because there are documents that Tippit arrived at the hospital. Well, the ambulance picked him up probably around 1:19. Although there's one document that says he was shot at 1:15, they crossed it out. That he was dead on arrival at 1:15, and they crossed it out and put 1:19. The ambulance headquarters was only a couple blocks from where he was shot. But there were other witnesses who gave the time earlier, but Tippit tried to call police radio at 1:08 and didn't get acknowledged because there was so much traffic on the radio. There was also a strange message to him at 12:45. Him and another officer, they said, be at large for any emergency that may happen, which is a strange thing to be singled out for at a time of maximum emergency when officers all over were racing around. Why did they single out Tippit? It was some kind of a signal. But I interviewed Tippit's father, Edgar Lee Tippit, who had never been interviewed except once by the FBI. And he was a very honest man, a very straightforward guy. He was 90 years old, but sharp as a tack. And he was still working as a farmer in East Texas. And he was a nice man. And he said he felt terrible that Oswald got shot because he wanted to know the truth about what happened to his son. But he said that soon after the assassination, he went to visit Marie Tippit, the officer's widow in Dallas. And she told him that shortly after the assassination, a policeman came to her and told her what happened. He said that Tippit and I were ordered to go to chase Oswald into Oak Cliff, where Oswald lived. And the police knew who Oswald was. And the official version is that they didn't know who he was until they got him to the police station at 2:10 p.m. They arrested him at 1:52. But So here at 12:45 or earlier, they knew who he was, they knew where he lived, and it is clear that the police had him under surveillance. And they, you know, as a lot of cities had or have, they had a kind of a red squad or, you know, subversive squad to track people like him. So they knew very well where he lived. And Mr. Tippett said that Marie said the officer told her they both were chasing Oswald to try to find him. And the guy said, I got into a car accident and didn't make it to the scene. JD made it and he got shot. And I feel guilty that JD got killed. And I found out the other officer was William Menzel, who was the guy assigned to that district. And he claimed in a report that he had been having lunch at a cafeteria and didn't hear about the assassination for a while, which is kind of incredible because, you know, most people knew about it. I knew about it before this guy claimed he knew about it. But he knew about it because he and Tippett were sent to Oak Cliff. And why they were sent there is not spelled out by this guy, but either arrest him or kill him. And I think killing him was the goal, you know, because at the theater, there was some evidence the police were trying to kill Oswald, but he managed to thwart it by shouting, I'm not resisting arrest. But I checked and there was a car accident two blocks from the Tippett shooting right around the same time. And Menzel was the officer who was sent to investigate the shooting, car accident. And he cleared the scene within, I believe, 4 minutes, which is kind of incredible because even if it's a fender bender, it takes more than 4 minutes to write it up and get the information. But I wonder if he had the accident, you know. The report on the accident never turned up. So here's Tippett going into this scene. I think Tippett drove into an ambush that was set up by the Dallas police. And then, you know, it's a matter of some speculation why he would be ambushed and shot. One of the things that took me a lot of thinking was there were about 20 people who saw all or parts of the Tippett murder scene, like when it happened or right after it happened. And they divide, interestingly, into about two camps. There are about 10 people who identified Oswald as the shooter. And then there are about 10 people who said there were either two men who did it or one man who did it. And the guy didn't look like Tippett. He was, Aquila Clemens said there was a short, stocky man, a description that fits Jack Ruby. And then there was a tall, thin man. And Oswald was not particularly tall. But a lot of these people, one person said that the shooter got into a car and drove off. And it almost, there's a fellow named Jerry Rose who wrote an article in the 90s. He had a theory that Jack Ruby staged the Tippett killing. He was heavily involved in the assassination. He tried to tell Earl Warren when he testified in the Dallas jail that he was more involved in the assassination plot than they realized. And Warren didn't want to hear that. He just said, I assure you that nobody has come forward to say that, Mr. Ruby. And Ruby said, well, you don't know the situation here. And he begged to be allowed to go to Washington to testify where he could speak more freely than in the jail. But the Tippett killing happened very close to Ruby's apartment. And Rose speculated that a lot of the witnesses were involved with Jack Ruby, and I found that to be true. People who worked for him in previous years, or the main Warren witness was Helen Markham, who was a waitress downtown. And she knew Ruby well because he came into her restaurant almost every night from his nightclub. And she was considered an utter screwball by one of the Warren lawyers, but they depended on her, even though her testimony was very confused. And she actually kept fainting during the lineup. And it was very obvious to identify Oswald as the suspect because he was the only guy disheveled and bloody and all that. But she got all confused and she kept fainting. And but she also said the shooting took place around 106, I believe. And she was walking to her bus stop, going to work, and she lived a couple blocks away, and the bus came at 1:12, and so you know that you would want to catch the bus and not miss your work. So it makes sense that she'd be walking there about 1:06 or 1:08, and it's questionable whether she even saw the shooting. She may have arrived just after it, but she was a very unreliable witness, but they depended on her. But there were two sets of witnesses. It was kind of like the Japanese film Rashomon, you know, two sets of reports. And some of the people who identified Oswald did so under suspicious circumstances. For example, a fellow named Warren Reynolds, who was a used car salesman who worked a block away, he saw what he thought was the gunman leaving the scene, and he pursued him a bit, and he refused to identify him as Oswald. He didn't think he was Oswald. And then he got shot in his place of business a couple months later after telling the FBI again that it wasn't Oswald. Somebody came in and shot him in the head, and he miraculously survived. And then he said, oh, okay, yeah, it was Oswald. You know, he later said, I wanted to live. And Domingo Benavides, the man closest to the shooting, he was in a pickup truck right across the street. He pulled up when he heard the shots, and he would not identify Oswald, so they wouldn't take him to a lineup, you know, and they tended to discount the people who wouldn't go along with their version. But 3 years later, in a CBS interview, he said, yeah, it was Oswald. So you can pretty much discount his identification. Plus, he had a brother who looked a lot like him, who was shot to death in a bar in the interim. You know, a lot of people who were witnesses to the Tippit shooting had death threats or violence against them. And Emil D'Antonio gave an interview, and he said when they were in Dallas, he and Mark Lane making the film Rush to Judgment, he said it was very easy to film in Dealey Plaza. Nobody bothered them. He said all the attention was around the Tippit scene. Everybody was very tense, very anxious. The witnesses were terrified, you know. That's interesting.
The Tippit case is the Rosetta Stone to the JFK killing. So there was David W. Bell, and he was the Warren Commission. But that was like the real, where people should have been looking to find who was really involved, according to them, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say that. You and I are thinking alike. David Bellin said the Rosetta Stone is, I even went to see the Rosetta Stone at the British Museum in London. But it was a huge stone, you know. But what he meant was that since Oswald killed Tippit, that meant he killed the president, which is a logical fallacy. But the Warren Commission hardly investigated the Tippit murder. It's almost an afterthought. As a matter of fact, I found a memo by Alfreda Scobie, who was a very smart lawyer, who was a protege of Richard Russell of Georgia. Senator Russell was on the Warren Commission. He was a skeptic. He didn't really believe the single bullet theory, et cetera. And Scobie was sort of his eyes and ears on the commission. And she wrote a memo to the head of the commission saying, is anybody looking into the Tippit murder? You know, it seems we should look into that. And then they ordered an FBI investigation, which was rather perfunctory. It took about a week, and it was just all superficial things. And they didn't bother investigating this. And that raised a flag in my mind, too. And another thing that raised the flag was in the Warren Report, 26 volumes, there were only two pictures of Tippit, and they're both really old. One was 1952, and another was 57, and he looked a lot different. When you see his autopsy pictures in 63 and other photos of him around that time, he's thinner, weathered looking, you know, older man. Didn't look similar. And I began thinking, that's very odd. Even in one of the Dallas papers, they printed a good picture, a recent picture of him that weekend, and they could have run that. I think they didn't want people to know what he looked like, because witnesses would come forward and say, oh yeah, we saw him here and we saw him there. And the House Select Committee did some investigating of Tippit, but not enough. They interviewed his mistress, Johnny Maxie Witherspoon, who he was having an affair with around that time. And I had a very revealing interview with her. She was very forthcoming. And they worked together at a diner called I'm blanking on the diner. It was a place where a lot of policemen and right-wingers gathered in Oak Cliff. And Tippett was in uniform as a security guard on weekends to control unruly teenagers. And, it was Austin's Barbecue. I'm sorry. I interviewed Austin Cook, the owner of the place. And Austin was a member of the John Birch Society, a right-winger, and he knew Edwin Walker, the general who was fired by Kennedy, who was living in Dallas and super right-winger. And Bill Alexander, deputy DA, who was fired by Henry Wade, the DA, because he was so extreme, he suggested that Earl Warren should be hanged, for example, and he got fired. And he was at the Tippett scene, and I had an interview with him, and he was very belligerent. Kind of a suspect in the case. And so these right-wingers who frequented the diner, there was Austin Cook had been involved in business with Ralph Paul, who was Jack Ruby's financial patron. He provided the money for Ruby to buy his nightclubs, et cetera. And so there are all these connections, Austin's Barbecue, where Tippett could have been recruited into the plot. And I investigated also whether Tippett could have even been one of the gunmen on the grassy knoll. It's inconclusive, but it's not outside the realm of possibility. He was, there was somebody called Badge Man behind the concrete retaining wall on the grassy knoll. And there are 7 photographs or motion picture films of that figure at the time of the shooting wearing a black uniform. And there's a picture by Marianne Moorman taken right during the shooting where you can see, when the photo is enhanced, you can see a man in a policeman's uniform firing a short gun. It's a very good location for a fatal shot. And you can see the badge and you can see the patch on the shoulder. And the guy is hatless, and Tippett had a very distinctive hairline. This is maybe one thing they're trying to hide. But when I went to the 6th floor museum during my research, they had a photograph of Tippett a year before the assassination. And he had a kind of a notch in his hairline, unusual looking notch. And the gunman on the grassy knoll has that same notch. So I began thinking about Tippett as a possible gunman. He could have done that. You know, a policeman firing would not be noticed. And there were people... There was a young black couple on a bench nearby there who said they saw a policeman running from the scene. And so I began investigating that. The alibi that would disprove that is that Tippett allegedly was at lunch with his wife and children at around the time of the assassination, although Mrs. Tippett has given numerous interviews over the years, she wouldn't give me an interview at the time. Although when I met her on Tippett's 90th birthday, they had an event at the 6th floor museum, and I went there to meet her, and she was very nice. And I said, I'm in town briefly, could I interview you tomorrow? And she seemed willing to do it. And her police minder came over and said, well, I'm in charge of her interviews. Give me your phone number and I'll get back to you. Of course, he never did. And she always had policemen around her for the rest of her life. She died a few years ago. They were very concerned with controlling who she talked to. And her son, Curtis, who was at the lunch, supposedly, he was at that event at the 6th Floor Museum. And I was talking to him after I talked to his mother. And he was a very friendly guy, very nice fellow. And Mrs. Tippett's police minder came over and literally grabbed Curtis by the arm and just yanked him away from me. It was very, very odd. But Mrs. Tippett gave a lot of different times for the alleged lunch and very conflicting information. And if he wasn't there for the lunch, then he could have been elsewhere. But you know, their home was about 7 miles from downtown Dallas. So if he was there for the lunch, he wouldn't have had time to be in downtown Dallas. But that is still an open question.
But didn't your research also find out, like, he had kind of psychological questions when he was a police officer? So he wasn't this kind of cut and dried, do it by the book cop. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, he was an undistinguished cop. I mean, he had no promotion in 11 years. He was not well educated. He had been through World War II in Europe, and he was a paratrooper, and he was very traumatized once by a paratroop drop from a low height. He was really suffered from that, and he had what we now call PTSD. He was very anxious after the war, and one of the things that he was known for, he couldn't look people in the eye, which is a potentially fatal thing for a police officer. And, you know, if he was shot, I mean, he was shot, whoever shot him, if you don't look somebody in the eye, they can get the drop on you and shoot you. And people said Tippett would, when he talked to people, look at the ground, you know, things like that, because he was so anxious. And he had a psychological evaluation, which was very disturbing. The psychologist said that Tippett exhibited strange signs. For example, he resorted to edging when they showed him cards, you know, Rorschach cards. Normally, a person picks up a card and looks at it and says something. Edging is when you turn the card sideways and you look at it from that way, which is very strange behavior. And the guy, the psychologist, wrote that Tippett had no imaginative faculties, and he might not be suited for police work, etc., you know. So he was not a very good policeman, but he was financially overextended. The Tippetts actually owned two homes. They had mortgages on them, which is a bit unusual for a guy who earned $438 a month. So he had moonlighting jobs as a security guard at Austin's Barbecue and a movie theater nearby, which was run by a fellow who was connected with organized crime and drug running. And during the Warren testimony by the police chief, Curry, Alan Dulles asked a question out of the blue. He said, there's a rumor Tippett was involved in drug dealing. Do you know about that? And Curry said, I don't know. But the Tippetts, they had these two homes. But I found out that in the summer of 63, Tippett came in some money. He bought a pickup truck for his father, and he bought a new station wagon for himself. And the family went on a vacation with relatives to the Grand Canyon, et cetera. He came into some money. And he had this mistress. They tried to portray him as a good family man and all, which he wasn't. He had other girlfriends, but this one mistress who I interviewed had had an affair with him for some months. She was a waitress at the barbecue place, and they would meet apparently at the barbecue place late at night and have sex. And there were stories that, I mean, one story was that on the day of the shooting, that morning, Mrs. Tippett came to some friend's house, and she was distraught, and she said, J.D. wants to divorce me. But according to Johnny Maxie Witherspoon, Mrs. Tippett wanted a divorce. So there are a lot of unanswered questions, but Johnny Maxie Witherspoon got pregnant, and around the time of the shooting is when she found out she was pregnant, and she had an estranged husband who was jealous, who was following them around. And some people have even tried to claim that he might have shot Tippett, but I don't think he did, because they're, you know, his movements are accounted for at the time of the shooting. But he claimed that the child who was born in the spring of 64, a daughter, was Tippett's child. And he got back together with his wife, and they raised the child. But Johnny Maxie Witherspoon says the child was not Tippett's, and she told me he had a vasectomy, couldn't have children anymore. And vasectomies are common now, but they were given in the 60s. They were rare. But, you know, there are other accounts that Tippett was in that location because he had a mistress nearby. The only thing Mrs. Witherspoon was evasive on, interestingly, was when I tried to pin her down where she was at the time of the shooting. She said she was at home and she wouldn't give me the address. She said she was doing the laundry, but you know, I wasn't quite sure where she lived, but that's another wrinkle, you know. But I tried to deal with various suspects in the case who've been mentioned as possible killers of Tippett, and I exonerated some of them. There's a fellow named Daryl Wayne Garner, who was a young hoodlum who was associated with Ruby, and he gave a very interesting interview to Mark Lane talking about how he was asked to help participate in the plot against Kennedy, and Clay Shaw was involved, Jack Ruby was involved, and he was a suspect, the prime suspect in the shooting of the witness Warren Reynolds. And Garner's girlfriend gave an alibi, and he claimed he was in Las Vegas at the time, but he might have been a shooter. And other people, I'm glad, you know, when you do a book, you hope other people will get inspired to pick up your research. That's what you hope for. People build on other people's research. And various people have investigated Captain Westbrook, had a personnel who rather unusually was at the scene of the Tippett murder very shortly after it happened. And he was heavily involved in it and may have been involved in planting evidence. And there's a reserve policeman named Kenneth Croy who was there suspiciously quickly too. And some people have said maybe he was involved. There was a witness, Mrs. Doris Holland, who said there was a police car in the alleyway. Tippett pulled up right, blocking an alley between two houses. And there was a police car there, and the shooter came out of the police car and fired a coup de grace into Tippett's head to make sure he was dead and went back into the police car, and the police car backed into the alley. There was another witness who saw that. And that puts a whole different wrinkle on the case. I write about that in my book.
Do you think it's possible that he was involved and they were just tying up loose ends by killing him and then blaming it on Oswald?
Well, yeah. See, I think there are different reasons. Like, for example, let's say Tippett was a grassy knoll shooter. If they had managed to kill Kennedy, Oswald, and Tippett within an hour, let's say, the Dallas police could have said, we're geniuses, we solved the case and wrapped it all up within an hour. It would have been hard to... There still would have been doubt about it, but you know, as it is, some people even say they were terrific. You know, they captured Oswald 152. You know, Kennedy was shot at 12:30. But Tippett's murder, it could have been done just to lure policemen into Oak Cliff, because when a policeman is shot, that takes precedence over anything. And I noticed in the police radio tapes that when Kennedy is shot, they're very blasé, like, President was shot. And then when the report came in, a civilian used the radio and said an officer was shot. Suddenly, the tapes are full of very agitated policemen speaking very quickly. A lot of calls come in. And I told Jim Lavelle, the head detective there, I said, I noticed that. And he said, yeah, that's true. When a policeman is shot, that's, you know, the most important thing for cops. And I said, what do you think the police attitude was when Kennedy was shot? And he broke into a little kind of wicked smile, and he said, well, it's like that old saying, it wasn't no different from a South Dallas N-word shooting. And he used the actual word, not N-word.
They just didn't care. I mean, wasn't there like a lot of Klan stuff too? I've seen other researchers where the guy who was escorting the three tramps had like a Klan tattoo. So there's some pretty very far right for those days people around. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, one of the people I interviewed, Tippett's oldest friend that I interviewed, was a guy named Horace Brumley, who was a retired detective in the Dallas Police Force. And he had grown up with Tippett in East Texas. And I had an interview with him. And I was sitting in a diner with him, and I had my tape recorder right in front of us going, and he pulled out his wallet, and he pulled out his Ku Klux Klan membership card, and he showed it to me. He was bragging about it, and I wrote down the information. It was the Grand Dragon, you know, he was signed up. And I said, well, what were you doing? And he said, well, I infiltrated the Klan for the Dallas police. But then he started bragging about how they had castrated black men for dating white women, and they whipped black men. And, you know, when you're an interview and you know this interviewer, you try to you try to keep a straight face and not really react to things very much, because you try to keep people talking. And I'm sorry, the telephone is ringing. Let me turn.
Okay. You want to answer it? Go ahead. I mean, we're kind of coming to the end here, Joseph. I mean, we're at about an hour.
Well, hour. I was just going to say, to wrap it up, you try to keep people talking, but I couldn't restrain myself from saying, well, since you're infiltrated at the police, did you report these crimes? And he immediately clammed up. But I told a Dallas researcher who knew more than I did about Dallas, and he said, infiltrated is a joke, because about three-fourths of the Dallas Klan were Dallas policemen. So it was a very racist police force. They didn't like Kennedy. Tippit, I couldn't find, he was not a member of the Klan as far as I know, and I couldn't find much evidence of political activity by him aside from being in a place where a lot of right-wingers worked. And his wife claimed he voted for Kennedy, but we don't really know. But anyway.
But I mean, you just capture so many problems with the narrative, the cover narrative of the story that Oswald did it all and ran over there. And then, you know, he must have been at a certain point, they were grooming him for a patsy. He just didn't see it coming. Do you kind of get that?
Yeah. My theory is that, and there's a lot of evidence that he was an FBI informant who had infiltrated the plot against Kennedy, and he was reporting to the FBI. And, one of my most extraordinary interviews with Henry Wade, the DA, who he indicated to me, like Lavelle did, that they didn't have much of a case on Oswald for killing Kennedy. And he expressed some doubts that weekend that Oswald did it alone, et cetera. But Wade said that Oswald had met with the Dallas police the day before, I mean, the FBI the day before the assassination. And I said, really, the day before? And he said, well, a day or two before. But he also met with the FBI on November 12th, they said, around November 12th, he went to the FBI office and delivered a note, which they later claimed was a threat to blow up the office because they were harassing his wife. But we don't really know, because the note was destroyed on the 24th at the command of Gordon Shanklin, the head of the FBI office there, who told Jim Hostey, Oswald's the agent assigned to the Oswalds, to flush it down the toilet. And then I found out on the 24th, before Oswald was shot, that morning paper said that Oswald had met with the FBI on November 16th as well, and that's kind of been forgotten. So there are two or three times Oswald met with the FBI in November of 63, which is very suspicious. And there are a lot of inklings that, I mean, he was being run by the CIA and he was being set up by the CIA. He was a false defector to Russia that would have involved the CIA. And they created what they called a legend about him, which is a series of mythical things that made him look like a hardcore communist, which he wasn't. But he was a loyal American, in my opinion, who has infiltrated the plot for the FBI. And then he didn't realize he was being set up as the patsy. Also, Kennedy was supposed to have been killed in Chicago on November 2nd, and the plot was foiled by the Secret Service and the Chicago police. They arrested some Cubans, but they let them go, and there was a patsy there who was similar to Oswald, but the plot was foiled partly because there was an informant named Lee who warned them about the plot. So Oswald's connections with the FBI were very suspicious. And as I say, when Tippit was shot, all these cars came pouring into Oak Cliff and they were draining downtown of police cars. So that hurt the investigation. And when you have the scene there like that, it's a high likelihood the suspect might get shot, but he survived. Dwight McDonald wrote that Oswald had a miraculous survival for 2 days in the custody of the Dallas police, and then they had to eliminate him. And they, in desperation, they brought in a mob, their mob bagman to the Dallas police, Jack Ruby, who was involved in the plot more than than the Warren Commission told us, and he shot him while he was surrounded by 60 policemen and dozens of newspapermen on live television. It really stinks to high heaven.
It's incredible. It's just a true, unbelievable story. Yeah. And just Jack Ruby, they just played him as like a, you know, a bar owner, but he was very connected, wasn't it? He had friends all over the place, Chicago, a gun running to Cuba, so there's a Cuba connection, is my understanding.
Yeah, they had a. They looked at his telephone records for the month or two before the assassination, and he made calls to many mob figures around the country. And when I was in my early research going to the National Archives, I was Xeroxing reports about Dallas policemen Ruby knew, and I finally had to stop because he really knew most of the Dallas policemen, hundreds of them, and he was the bag man. He would provide them with money and girls and liquor at his club, etc. And and he was the liaison with the mob. So the Tippit case is a Rosetta Stone, but it's different from what David Belin meant in the Warren Commission. But I'm glad that I advanced the case with knowing what Tippit and Menzel were trying to do, and they had to have been plot to be given that order that early. And So more people are looking into the Tippit murder. And then Political Truth, my book on the media and the assassination, I connect the loss of faith that our country had in the government and the media. A lot of people thought it began with the Vietnam War, but it really began with the assassination. People began realizing they weren't being told the truth. And it escalated with Watergate and all these other things that have happened. And it is healthy to be skeptical of the government and press, and my whole book is analyzing the lying press coverage of the assassination, and also not just the press, but television, radio, movies, etc. But it's gotten to the point where half the country now believes one set of facts, half the country believes mythical things. And we see the danger of that with the storming of the Capitol on January 6th, the attempted coup. And it took one of the things I criticized the media for was not calling the coup for what it was right away. The Washington Post even put out a video saying it wasn't a coup, a lot of specious reasons. Now they refer to it as a coup. It's become rather common to call it that, coup attempt. But we had a successful coup in November of 63, which they won't admit. They can't admit that in the mainstream media. And that's what I attack in my Political Truth.
Right, and Political Truth. And then this one, Into the Nightmare, I like the fact that you kind of are following these researchers and giving your opinion on some that might not be sketchier than other people think. So you get a lot of firsthand experience comes through in this book. And so I liked reading along with that as you kind of advance down your kind of research path. So that was another aspect of the book I really liked. But the best place to get it is on Amazon.
Yeah, right? Two self-published books on the assassination, which are fulfilled by Vervante, a Utah company. You can buy them only through Amazon. And they process it, and it'll be shipped to you quickly from Vervante. So I recommend people do that. And I've been researching this most of my life, and even before the assassination, I was involved in researching what could have happened.
And you have a website, don't you? Or do you have a social media?
Well, I had a website, devoted to all my works, but I was so busy last year and early this year. I had four books out, my Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, and Political Truth, and I did a book called Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, Portrait of an Independent Career. I updated that, and I did a book on the Coen brothers called The Whole Durn Human Comedy, Life According to the Coen Brothers. So I was so busy, I neglected to renew my site, and it disappeared. But I have a couple of sites up there. I'm told that my Into the Nightmare site also disappeared, unfortunately. I have to get them running again. I will, but I have sites on my memoir, The Broken Places, and my book, Two Cheers for Hollywood, which is a collection of my short works. But I need to get back on. I have websites that are handy for people to read. But if you go on Amazon, it links to all my books, and most of them are still in print. I'm now working on getting some of the out-of-print books back into print.
Well, good luck with that. And do you, so people can reach you through social media, is that right? Or do you have an email you want to share?
Yeah, they can write to me, and people do write to me, which is interesting, and I appreciate it. And I put my address in my books, but it's Joe Mack, JOEMAC, 809@gmail.com. JOEMAC, 809@gmail.com. And it is really nice to hear from readers, and a lot of people really care about the case. And when you write a book, you don't know who your readers are exactly, but you get to meet them occasionally and hear from them, which is a part of the reward of writing a book. And I like internet forums. I'm in the Education Forum, which is a good site that debates the assassination. A lot of good researchers post their discoveries and things. And so a lot of things are still being learned about the case. And then we'll see next month what happens when the deadline comes again for the president to decide on releasing more documents. Let's hope.
And you wanted to talk about also the what's happening with Dealey Plaza, too. Can you make a quick mention?
There's a terrible thing happening that Dealey Plaza in Dallas has been preserved. And, you know, that's where Kennedy was shot. And you see the grassy knoll. You see the railroad overpass. And you see the Texas School Book Depository. And long ago, they were going to tear down the Texas School Book Depository, which was terrible that people protested, and they didn't. But now they have this plan to sort of ruin Grassy Knoll, take out the fence, plant trees, make a walkway up there for people to stroll around on, and turn the parking lot behind it into a park, tear down the signal tower where Lee Bowers said he saw a gunman from. And it's a terrible, terrible idea. I think historical sites in our country should be preserved. It's like, it'd be like tearing down the White House and building a high rise. I mean, it's a ridiculous idea. So I hope
like tearing down the courthouse at Appomattox or something like that, like just incredibly important events.
Well, Ford's Theater, when I first went there in 61, where Lincoln was shot, I was shocked to find the interior was empty, been gutted. Right after the killing, they irrationally gutted the interior. Then they put in some government offices, and there was a terrible incident where some floors collapsed and people were killed. But what's there now is a reconstruction of the interior, very beautifully executed. It's not the actual interior, but it looks like it. They've done a good job on it. The basement has a museum of weapons and things, very chilling. But fortunately, they didn't tear down the building. But America has a tendency to obliterate the past. Gore Vidal calls our country the United States of Amnesia. And once you start destroying historical sites, battlefields, buildings, et cetera, people have a tendency to forget. There's no place to gather and you know, look at and try to figure out what happened. Right. So there was a meeting, public meeting in Dallas a couple of days ago about this, and I hope people continue to protest. I'm going to be among the protesters. We want to keep it as it was. And a lot of people go there and visit. And the first time I met Penn Jones in 1983, he was on Dealey Plaza. He was leading every year. He would lead a kind of remembrance of Kennedy. And I said, that was terrific. Are you going to go to the memorial that they have is a couple blocks away, this very empty kind of memorial, kind of symbolic of their attitude in Dallas. They want to kind of forget the assassination and not really make sense of it. And he said, I'm not going to go there. He said, the holy ground is where the martyr falls. So that's how I think of Dealey Plaza. Let's keep it as it is so people can remember and visit and think about the case.
Yeah, a solemn moment, too. I think it's very important. People are looking around there. When I was just there this year, they're thinking, they're looking around, they're in a place that something very important happened. So taking that away would be a real mistake, a disgrace to for history, for people, not generations from now, generations 150 years from here, as long as there's people in the States. They have to remember this so it doesn't happen again. That's really the importance of these talks, these books, the books you're writing. So thanks so much for writing this book, Joseph McBride. Title again is Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit, published 2013. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, William, and thank you for having me again. It's always a pleasure.
My pleasure. Likewise. Cool. Stay up.